They are paid to instill virtue and democratic values by the state government down in Trenton and that satanic government farther down in Washington. But the values they believe in are godless.
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Netta Ulibi. This week, John Updike reads from his post-9/11 thriller. Terrorist is about a pious Muslim teenager in New Jersey who's led step by step into a diabolical plot. The author claims he never even read a novel until he was 15 years old, but he didn't lose much time after that. Updike published his first New Yorker short story at age 23. He's written more than 50 books since then that include forays into science fiction, magical realism, and children's literature. John Updike won the Pulitzer Prize in 1981 and again 9 years later for his novels Rabbit is Rich and Rabbit at Rest. His portraits of the emotional wasteland of suburbia helped define American fiction in the second half of the 20th century. This reading of Terrorist took place in June of 2007 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Thank you.
I don't feel, actually, as a writer now of 75, that I am thoroughly assimilated to the world most of you live in. When you're a young writer, you basically are the news. You are the new thing, and you have no doubts about your ability to speak about a society. And you don't really lose this, or I didn't lose it until I got into my 50s and realized that, you know, I was turning into a fuddy-duddy, talking about the good old days and why are people so irreverent. And now I notice, as a novelist, this novel takes place in part in an American high school in a rundown industrial city, but nevertheless a high school with all these young people in it, and I hardly have one of them make a cell phone call. And when I look at the reality of teenagers now, they all have cell phones. It's become a wonderful instrument whereby parents, you can never quite shake them since they're always there in your pocket about to ring and find out where you are and when you're coming home. It's a curtailment, actually, of freedom that would have been a shock to me as a teenager myself. However, it is one of the innovations that it's hard to assimilate to a fictional text here. I don't want to read more than I should, and it's amazing to me how little prose it takes to fill a half hour. And in fact, I have 20 minutes. So I have two short sections to try to lay out for those who haven't read the book, and indeed, why should you in a world so full of books begging to be read. Read a couple of the opening pages in which we enter into the mind of young Ahmad Meshawi Malloy, the son of a Irish-American nurse and would-be, in fact, she is a practicing painter, a bohemian free spirit who in her youth linked up with an Egyptian exchange student and they got married and had Ahmad or Ahmad, and at three, the father defected, unable to quite make the connections in America that he'd hoped for. So this is a fatherless boy raised by what they somewhat cloyingly call a single mom, and as consolation to himself, he's. And it's some attempt to make a gesture toward the absent father. And it is a psychological fact, I think, that absence is a kind of presence in your mind. So you can spend a lot of your life trying to placate or appeal to or attract somebody or something that's not there. We begin in his mind. He's at the high school, and this is just his view of the environment around him. He's 18 and a senior, and a devout Muslim. Have I said that? He turns to the local mosque, perhaps in part as a search for a center of order, and a father, a figure, and is very pious and pure, and literal-minded in his faith. Devils, Ahmad thinks, these devils seek to take away my God. All day long at Central High School, girls sway and sneer and expose their soft bodies and alluring hair. Their bare bellies adorned with shining navel studs and low-down purple tattoos ask, what else is there to see? Boys strut and saunter along and look dead-eyed, indicating with their edgy killer gestures and careless scornful laughs that this world is all there is, a noisy varnished hall lined with metal lockers and having at its end a blank wall desecrated by graffiti and roller-painted over so often it feels to be coming closer by millimeters. The teachers, weak Christians and non-observant Jews, make a show of teaching virtue and righteous self-restraint, but their shifty eyes and hollow voices betray their lack of belief. They are paid to say these things by the city of New Prospect and the state of New Jersey. They lack true faith. They are not on the straight path. They are unclean. Ahmad and the 2,000 other students can see them scuttling after school into their cars on the crackling, trash-speckled parking lot like pale crabs or dark ones restored to their shells. And they are men and women like any others, full of lust and fear and infatuation with things that can be bought. Infidels, they think safety lies in accumulation of the things of this world and in the corrupting diversions of the television set. They are slaves to images, false ones of happiness and affluence. But even true images are sinful imitations of God who can alone create. Relief at escaping their students unscathed for another day makes the teachers' chatter of farewell in the halls and on the parking lot too loud, like the rising excitement of drunks. The teachers revel when they are away from the school. Some have the pink lids and bad breaths and puffy bodies of those who habitually drink too much. Some get divorces. Some live with others unmarried. Their lives away from the school are disorderly and wanton and self-indulgent. They are paid to instill virtue and democratic values by the state government down in Trenton and that satanic government farther down in Washington. But the values they believe in are godless. Biology and chemistry and physics. On the facts and formulas of these, their false voices firmly rest, ringing out into the classroom. They say that all comes out of merciless blind atoms, which cause the cold weight of iron, the transparency of glass, the stillness of clay, the agitation of flesh. Electrons pour through copper threads and computer gates, and the air itself when stirred to lightning by the interaction of water droplets. Only what we can measure and deduce from measurement is true. The rest is that passing dream we call ourselves. Ahmad is 18. This is early April. Again, green sneaks seed by seed into the drab city's earthy crevices. He looks down from his new height and thinks that to the insects, unseen in the grass, he would be, if they had a consciousness like his, God. In the year past, he has grown 3 inches to 6 feet, more unseen materialist forces working their will upon him. He will not grow any taller. He thinks in this life or the next, if there is a next. An inner devil murmurs. What evidence beyond the prophet's blazing and divinely inspired words prove that there is a next? Where would it be hidden? Who would forever stoke hell's boilers? What infinite source of energy would maintain opulent Eden, feeding its dark-eyed Uris, sweating, swelling its heavy-hanging fruits, renewing the streams and splashing fountains in which God, as described in the ninth surah of the Quran, takes eternal good pleasure? What of the second law of thermodynamics? And so on. He is obviously hard to please. But what as I've read this passage more than once, I'm struck by how soon I introduce the note of doubt within him, this fervent believer, and all around him he sees potential or actual devils trying to take his faith from him. So the book, in a way, is a long struggle with a doubt and a boy trying to keep his faith. If I were a teacher, which I'm not, and were to assign a comparable text or another useful text to shed light on this odd book, it would be a short story I wrote many years ago called Pigeon Feathers, in which a 13-year-old boy in confirmation class in a Lutheran church in a rural Pennsylvania discovers that the minister doesn't really believe any of this, not in the literal way in which it was intended. And his struggle is recorded in that short story, and there's a lot of that boy in my young Muslim. From my second selection, I was going to read a distinctly political piece of this book. I think this, what I read you was the actual opening pages, but I think I wrote this passage to be the opening pages, and then I realized that it wouldn't quite do. In fact, maybe it doesn't do at all, but I stuck with it. It describes a politician in Washington, where most of you know a lot more than I do about Washington and its citizenry, but I have been here before, and felt entitled as an imaginative writer to try to enter the mentality of a fictional Secretary for Homeland Security. We know that he's fictional because earlier on, there's a linkage between all these levels of the fairly large cast of characters. The key link really is that the other hero of the book, the Jewish guidance counselor, tired and cynical but still somewhat responsive to an appealing student, Jack Levy. Jack Levy's wife, his rather inert wife, sister, this is his stream of consciousness, Hermione Fogel is the sister's name, and Hermione's boss is the Secretary of Homeland Security, a born-again right-wing stooge with some kraut name like Haffenreffer down in Washington. That's Jack Levy talking or thinking. I tried to, what does fiction do at its best? One of the things really is to try to dramatize our sense with us constantly, but almost invisibly, almost insensibly, to dramatize our sense of time passing and the immense tragedy that time's passing is. And you feel this in Proust, say, of course, but also in a novel, a more conventional novel like The Age of Innocence, in which we're dropped at the end out of a very vivid and moving present into a future where it's all different and all gone and so on. Another thing that great novels can do is show us how interconnected society is, that however secure and sealed in and locked in each class may feel to itself. In a novel like Bleak House, you see how even a totally impoverished, dying, little ragamuffin corner sweeper Joe that he can touch and affect drastically the life of somebody like Lady Dedlock. And there's something in this book, in a way, of an attempt to show links that go from Washington right into the unpromising city of New Prospect, New Jersey, which is where my characters live. But, all right, this is just 5 pages trying to show the upper end of the problem. On Sunday morning, while most Americans are still in bed, though a few are struggling out to an early mass or a scheduled golf match in the dew, the Secretary for Homeland Security upgrades the so-called terror threat level from yellow, meaning merely elevated, to orange, meaning high. That's the bad news. The good news is that the higher level applies only to specific areas of Washington, New York, and northern New Jersey. The rest of the nation remains on yellow. The Secretary tells the nation, in his all but sublimated Pennsylvania accent, that recent intelligence reports, in what he terms, quote, alarmingly close and harmonious detail, end quote, indicated an attack upon sensitive targets in those specific eastern metropolitan areas, which the enemies of freedom have been studying with the most sophisticated tools of reconnaissance. Financial centers, sports arenas, bridges, tunnels, subways, nothing is safe. You may expect to see, he tells the lens of the television camera, which is like a gun-colored, lens-covered porthole on whose other side presses an ocean of trusting, anxious citizens, special buffer zones to secure the perimeters of buildings from unauthorized cars and trucks, restrictions to affected underground parking, security personnel using identification badges and digital photos to keep track of people entering and exiting buildings, increased law enforcement presence, and robust screening of vehicles, packages, and deliveries. He cherishes and emphasizes the phrase robust screening. It conjures up an image of strapping men in green or gray-blue jumpsuits, tearing apart vehicles and packages, venting in their vigor the Secretary's daily frustration at the difficulty of his task. His task is to protect, in spite of itself, a nation of nearly 300 million anarchic souls. Their millions of daily irrational impulses and self-indulgent actions flitting out of sight just around the edge of feasible surveillability. This mob's collective gaps and irregularities form a perfect rough surface whereupon the enemy can grow one of his tenacious, wide-spreading plots. Destruction, the Secretary has often thought, is so much easier than construction and disruption than social order, that the upholders of a society must always lag behind those who would destroy it, just as he had been a football player for Lehigh in his youth. A fleet-footed receiver can always gain a step on the defending cornerback. And God bless America, he publicly concludes. The red light above the little porthole goes off. He is off the air. He abruptly shrinks in size. Now his words will be heard by only the handful of TV technicians and loyal staffers around him. Here in this cramped media facility, sunk 100 bomb-proof feet beneath Pennsylvania Avenue. Other cabinet-level officials get marble and limestone federal buildings so long that each has its own horizon, whereas he must function huddling in a small windowless office in the basement of the White House. With a Herculean sigh of weariness, the secretary turns from the camera. He is a large man, with a slab of muscle across his back that gives the tailors of his dark blue suits extra trouble. In his massive head, his mouth looks truculently small. His haircut on that same head also looks small, like a hat belonging to someone else, but jammed on anyway. His Pennsylvania accent is not a broad, syllable-swallowing growl like Lee Iacocca's, or a piercing honk like Arnold Palmer's. Of a generation younger than they, he speaks in a neutral, media-friendly English, which only in its tense solemnity and certain vowel shadings betrays its source in a commonwealth renowned for seriousness, for earnest effort and stoic submission, for Quakers and coal miners, for Amish farmers and God-fearing Presbyterian steel magnates. "What'd you think?" he asks an assistant, a slender, pink-eyed fellow Pennsylvanian, 64 but virginal, Hermione Fogel. Hermione's transparent skin and fluttering, embarrassed demeanor express an instinctive underling's yearning for personal invisibility. In the spirit of cumbersome fun with which the secretary expressed his affection and trust, he brought her with him from Harrisburg and gave her an informal title, Undersecretary for Women's Purses. The problem was real enough. Women's purses were sinkholes of confusion and sedimented treasure in whose depths any number of compact terrorist weapons, retractable box cutters, exploding sarin pellets, lipstick-shaped stun guns, could be secreted. It was Hermione who had helped develop the search protocols for this crucial area of darkness, including the simple wooden stick with which security guards at entrances could probe the depths and not give offense with the rummaging touch of their naked hands. The majority of security personnel were recruited from the minorities, and many women, especially older women, recoiled from the intrusion of black or brown fingers into their purses. The dozing giant of American racism, lulled by decades of official liberal sing-song, stirred anew as African Americans and Hispanics, who, it was often complained, can't even speak English properly, acquired the authority to frisk, to question, to delay, to grant or deny admission, and the permission to fly. In a land of multiplying security gates, the gatekeepers multiply also. To the well-paid professionals who traveled the airways and frequented the newly fortified government buildings, it appears that a dusky underclass has been given tyrannical power. Comfortable lives that even a decade ago moved fluidly through circuits of privilege and assumed access, now encounter sticking points at what seem every step, while maddeningly deliberate guards ponder driver's licenses and boarding passes. Where once a confident manner, a correct suit and tie, and a business card measuring 2 by 3.5 inches had opened doors, the switch is no longer tripped. The door remains closed. How can the fluid, hydraulically responsive workings of capitalism, let alone the commerce of intellectual exchange and the social life of extended families, function through such obdurate thicknesses of precaution? The enemy has achieved his goal. Business and recreation in the West are gummed up exorbitantly so. I thought it went very well, as usual, Hermione Fogel responds to a question the secretary has all but forgotten. He is preoccupied. The clashing claims of privacy and security, convenience and safety are his daily diet. And yet his compensation in terms of public admiration is nearly nil, and in terms of financial compensation, distinctly modest. With children approaching the age of college education and a wife who must keep up her end in the endless social rounds of Republican Washington, except for a black single woman, a polyglot academic and accomplished pianist in charge of long-range global strategy, the secretary's colleagues in the administration were born rich and have made additional fortunes in the private sector during their 8-year holiday from public service under Clinton. In those fat years, the secretary had been grinding his way upward through low-paying government posts in the Keystone State. Now all the Clintonians, including the Clintons themselves, are getting pig-rich with their tell-all memoirs, while the secretary, loyal and stolid, is wedded to tight-mouthed secrecy now and ever after. Not that he knows anything his Arabists don't tell him. The world they monitor, of electronic chatter crackling with poetic euphemism and pathetic braggadocio, is as alien and repellent to the secretary as any underworld of sleepless geeks, even those of Caucasian blood and Christian upbringing. When the heaven splits asunder in the east and reddens like a rose or stained leather, the insertion into this clause from the Quran, the non-Quranic in the east, may or may not, coupled with various rambling and extravagant confessions of captured operatives, justify the elevation of the level of police and military watchfulness accorded certain Eastern financial institutions of the spectacular skyscraping sort, attractive to the enemy's superstitious mentality. The enemy is obsessed with holy sites, and as convinced as the old communist archenemies had been that capitalism has a headquarters, a head that may be cut off, leaving flocks of the faithful to be gratefully herded into an ascetic and dogmatic tyranny. The enemy cannot believe that democracy and consumerism are fevers in the blood of every man, an outgrowth of each individual's instinctive optimism and desire for freedom. Even for a stout churchgoer like the secretary, a will of God fatalism and a heavy bet on the next world have been left behind in the dark ages. Those who still hold to the bet have one thing going for them: they are eager to die. The unbelievers love this fleeting life too well. That was another verse that kept coming up in the internet chatter. I'll be knocked for this, the secretary gloomily confides to his so-called undersecretary. If nothing happens, I'm a scaremonger. If it does, I'm a lazy leech on the public payroll who allowed the death of thousands. No one would say such things, Hermione reassures him, her sallow spinster skin reddening with sympathetic feeling. Everyone, even the Democrats, knows you are doing an impossible job that nevertheless must be done for the sake of our national survival. That about says it, I guess, the object of her admiration admits, his mouth pinched even smaller by a conscious wryness. The elevator smoothly returns them with two armed security guards, one male, one female, and a trio of gray-suited staffers to the level of the White House basement. Outside, church bells are ringing in sunshine blended and sunshine blended of Virginia and Maryland rays. The secretary muses aloud, "Those people out there, why do they want to do these horrible things? Why do they hate us? What's to hate?" "They hate the light," Hermione tells him loyally, "like cockroaches, like bats. The light shone in darkness," she quotes, knowing that Pennsylvania piety is a way to his heart, and the darkness comprehended it not. Thank you. That's the imaginary Secretary of Home Security at work. Yeah, I thought I owed it to the reader and to an honest survey of the problem to have this Washington level, though I can't claim that this is a Washington novel. It's and my novel of Washington is inaccurate. I'm not sure that the Homeland Security Secretary is in the White House basement, but at some point he didn't have, I know, a real one. Tom Rich didn't have much space to work with, as well as a nightmare of a situation. Now, the novel, I don't want to give away the plot, but anyway, Jack Levy gets a little involved with Ahmad, and more than a little involved with Ahmad's fetching free spirit of a mother, and so in some way her sisterhood with Hermione connects at the end, or toward the end, the several levels of this plot of this story of terrorism as I tried to understand it. And there's a lot I don't know about Islam or about terrorism, but I thought I could present a sympathetic portrait of a young man who step by step is led from being a pious young Muslim to getting into a terrorist plot. And in trying to treat such a subject, one thinks that there has been a devaluation of life almost. It used to be complained of our Japanese enemies that life was cheap for them and life is not cheap to Americans, but you wonder with all these high school massacres, how cheap is life to so many teenagers who don't have somehow enough to do, enough constructive to engage them. All right, enough of that. I'm open to questions. I think there are sharp-eyed people with a roving microphone who will, if you raise your hand, they're kind of in control. In the middle, we see a hand.
In the, let's say, the Rabbit series of books, reading them multiple times, I was struck with the density of description of what was going on and politics and so on, all filtered through Rabbit. And I could imagine you might have known someone like Rabbit, but I don't know. I don't think you knew anyone like Ahmad. I don't think you knew anyone like Ahmad. Did you do anything particular here differently to prepare, to give what seems like a pretty dense description of what he's up to and what he's thinking?
Rabbit and Ahmad do have some similarities. They're both loners. And there's a noticeable dearth in both cases of real male friends, so that in a sense they're both idealistic in a way. They're both aspiring towards something else, something beyond. Rabbit says there's something out there that wants me to find it. And Ahmad is further along in the pilgrimage in a way and has a different religion, but the same attraction to another world, a better world, a purer world. Mohammedism, Islam insists the word purity keeps returning and keeps returning in Ahmad's thinking. Pure. People aren't pure enough. The world isn't pure enough. So in a way, they're not totally dissimilar, although they are dissimilar in many ways. Both live, as it happens, in a kind of fading industrial city also. about the same size, one in Pennsylvania and one in New Jersey. Obviously, when I began to write about Rabbit, I happened upon deep soil for me. This is my land. This is my kind of youth that he's experienced. So I found that the first book, Rabbit Run, which I wrote with no intention of a sequel and no real knowledge that I could write a full-length novel, I discovered that the thing was rolling along with that present tense, and there was plenty to say suddenly, plenty to see in my mind's eye, plenty to translate in terms of his feelings and the feelings of other characters. So it was what you call a rich vein, and rich enough that I went back to it repeatedly. And each time I returned, I discovered that although writing is never totally easy, that really those books were about as easy writing as I've ever done. They almost seem to write themselves in the cliche that artists sometimes hide behind. Whereas I was timid of this topic, knew I was on thin ice in a way, and had some difficulty getting started. As I said, I began in the first person and wound up in the third because I thought it gave me access to more characters and more levels of event. And also I did begin it on this somewhat faintly and very faintly satirical portrait of an executive in Homeland Security, and it seemed to me sort of the wrong note to begin on, maybe the wrong note to strike, and after all a very serious matter, a serious topic. But it is, I think the original title of the book might have been Land of Fear, because that's a change that happened after 9/11, and that we can see it in our daily lives. Anybody who flies, anybody who gets into public buildings, anybody who observes public buildings, all these little cement posts, truck stops that have sprung up around public buildings, not just in Washington, all that is a significant infringement of our freedom to just move about and go where we want to. It's hard to be the schoolmaster who has to pick out the hands. And I hope I don't favor people who look like me. Where is that?
As you were just saying, or as the previous questioner mentioned, that you wrote about Rabbit in many venues. And so my question would be, having given us or having introduced us to Ahmad now and very clearly capturing this person from the inside at a particular, very limited point in his life, and leaving us, for those of us who have read the book, the only thing I'll give away is that he clearly lives. So do you feel, or do you plan, or do you want, or do you suspect that you will follow him?
I don't really. I've written more sequels than I ever intended to. I basically think a sequel is a cop-out kind of thing, and it's alarming to see Hollywood turn so ardently to sequels. Every movie, hit movie this summer is a sequel. But you can see how people get into it, and you can even see how writers get into it. You invent a character, name him. That's not always easy. You name him, you give him some physical characteristics, and how much easier it is to pick him up again at a different moment in his life, his or her life, and write again about him. And Henry Beck is another continuous character of mine who, again, I wrote one story about being in the Eastern Europe during the height of the Cold War in 64. And the story seemed to go well enough that, again, I had this feeling of a rich vein, load of ore. So I don't have that feeling about Ahmad, really, and don't want to give away any ending of the book because it is a more suspenseful book than my books usually are, and I deplore reviewers who give away a lot of plot, and in my own reviews I try not to give away a lot of plot, but even if we grant that he has some kind of a future, I'd say it's pretty murky right now, and I'm not qualified to light it up. I lit up what I could. I was once 18, and I could handle him as an 18-year-old, but probably not as a 28-year-old. Yes.
I have read the book, this may be a question that you might prefer not to answer for those who have not read the book. But could you comment on the role that the Iman plays in this young man's life? Or is that an unfair question for those who have not read the book?
Well, I think it's fairly quickly perceived by a reader that the imam is, in a way, sinister, and maybe too much so. One radio interviewer said the imam reminded him of Fu Manchu, and but to me, he was a complex man, actually, with doubts of his own, a kind of sardonic, ironical approach, a man from Yemen with a kind of a warrior mentality who is engaged, maybe to quell some of his doubts, who is engaged in a war. And he enlists his young acolyte in that war. And he is the link between international Islamic militantism and my mundane, peace-loving Americans. I enjoyed trying to write about him. He explicates the Quran in an interesting way, and I thought that part of the service I might perform for my readers was to acquaint them with a little bit of the Quran. It's a book we hear about, but it's not easy to read, and I've read it a couple times. Marvelous poetry even comes through in English. A book with a lot of burning in it, a lot of God's roasting the non-believers in it, so that it's not entirely an invention of Osama bin Laden, this streak of a vengeful God whose believers on earth have a duty to rebuke at the least and exterminate at the worst the unbelievers. Anyway, he is he is my idea of a link between an ordinary high school student and a world of international intrigue.
Hearing you use the term "seeing in your mind's eye," it takes me to the creative process itself. When you are writing at your best, what is transacting in your consciousness?
Good question. Would that one exactly knew what was going on, but you've lived a life, or you are living a life, and certain images have stuck in your mind and are meaningful to you. The scenes of your childhood and boyhood are certainly meaningful, have a meaning beyond your ability to communicate it. I once tried to write a novel about an adolescent to whom, in his world, the people around him were Greek gods. I mean, everybody had an immense presence, and I remember my family doctor and the family minister and the people teaching at the high school. They all weren't just people, but they were huge presences to my young, semi-formed sense of things. And so these images of childhood, of youth, including the architecture and the diet, all that maybe is easier to draw upon than later images. But you even some place you've never been and an experience you've never had, nevertheless can happen to be very meaningful to you and to generate a verbal expression and generate in you a wish to get this down exactly, to create a little image of the reality that you either remember or have imagined out of half-buried memories. I think if you wander totally away from your own memory, you're probably wandering into unfertile soil. One of the Islamic tenets, and one not so easy for a Westerner to understand, is this abhorrence of imagery, of visual imagery as blasphemy, as trying to usurp God's prerogative as the creator, and that every artist who tries to bring something into visual realization is trying to oust God from the role of sole creator. So that's why there's no pictures in mosques, whereas Christian religion has generated, well, it's really generated major Western art for much of its life. From the Middle Ages to the end of the Renaissance, Christian art was art. But yeah, so I don't know what's in my mind. Also, the words matter. Sometimes just putting down some words begins to breed other words and breed pictures and words, because you're trying to write dialogue as well, trying to listen to your characters as well as see them. Some days go better than others, but I began life as a would-be cartoonist. I wanted to be a comic strip writer rather than I never thought of becoming a novelist. I hardly read a novel until I was about 15. So the visual imagination, being able to visualize things, is perhaps more important to me than it is to many other fiction writers and poets.
Thank you. As an editor of short stories and books and poetry and so forth, I wonder the perennial question, where is literature going, particularly in this country? I'm always surprised that in this age of the, you know, nanosecond, that the short story is still comes after the novel, and certainly poetry way below that in terms of the market. I wonder what's your feeling of where it's going now that you've reached this age of wisdom and contemplation? Thank you.
A lot of the trends are pretty clear. People have more electronic entertainment at their fingertips than they used to. And the portion of the day, I think the Victorians, a lot of them, used to read in the afternoons. And certainly young people, when I was a reader, I thought it was no sin to read while the sun was shining, and I'd rather do that than go outdoors. So there was a feeling if you could devote a whole day to a book. Wallace Stevens, the Berks County poet, said that his father used to Sunday afternoons go into a room and lock the door and read a novel. This kind of reading, I think, has been ousted by first the movies and, in a mild way, the radio, and certainly with a big thump, TV, and now we have the internet and its charming quality of feedback, of being interactive. So I think people, by and large, read less, that they still read at all, that there can be an audience like this and bookstores like, what's it called, Prose and Politics, is really the marvelous thing, rather than the fact that the publishing industry, which have, ever since I've been associated with it, has been crying the blues. I mean, things have never been that rosy in the publishing industry. To hear the publishers talk, I think there will be like the Christian catacombs, there will be a little huddle of readers still, because reading, and I'm talking really about imaginative writing rather than journalism, which has its own vigorous life, but it's also menaced by the rise of other alternative forms of news coverage and fact delivery. You can do more with language than I think you can. I mean, you certainly can create a multi-layered and even somewhat ambiguous and, may I say, flirtatious interaction with a reader. You can give them something that he can reread and get more out of it. And I'm not sure too many TV shows would benefit from being shown repeatedly. Whereas reading, there's always something more, and it engages the private self. In that way, it's antisocial, as Marshall McLuhan and others, but he most notably pointed out, it is anti-village. It's anti-village, and we do live increasingly in an electronic, I guess, village where reading plays a secondary part, or less of a major part. I went to college in the 50s when reading was still kind of king. We really almost worshipped figures like Eliot and even the deplorable Ezra Pound, but they represented something to us of what words could do and what art, what literary art could do. And although the bad news is I don't think this sense of an exalted calling is still in the air, the good news is that a lot of, I mean, if you care about reading and writing, the good news is that a lot of people still seem to want to be writers. They often want to be writers without having read much, and I think that this is something of a handicap. although I'm not sure writers are the greatest readers. We are producers rather than consumers, but there is a certain amount of homework that you should do, and I'm not sure the kids now do it. But the notion to me of sitting in a room, not having to put on a suit or a necktie, and producing a product that is almost 100% mine, this is my idea, my prose, my typing, and having it made into a manufactured object and sold around and offered to people via vastness of the U.S., all that was very thrilling to me, and I think remains thrilling to a lot of young people. So, yeah, this isn't entirely the scene. And, of course, the news is full now of the newspapers, one by one, pulling out of the reviewing business. In Atlanta, the paper is not going to review fiction at all, I think. Washington remains a place where they still get out a separate supplement. But how many of those really exist in the country? There's the New York Times and the Post, and I don't know who else gets them out. The Boston Globe, in a very reading part of the country, has cut back its book coverage. In some way, the printing is the printed word is no longer a hot medium as it was in Dickens' day. Anybody who can fight their way to the microphone.
I've studied your writing for a while now. And one question I have about it is that I've noticed with your settings a lot of time, it tends to reflect a sense of hopelessness in a lot of characters. For instance, Sammy and A and P, or even Ahmed and Terrace. And I was wondering what your motivations are for having that setting reflect a lot of the character's personality.
If I understand the question, I suppose I see not just me, but I think most affected people see disillusion and disappointment as part of living, a part of growing older. And the writer always has the safety shield of it's him or her who's writing this. So perhaps I, writing, don't feel in A&P Sammy's momentary disappointment as fully as a young reader, and evidently you do. It is true that his attempt to be gallant on behalf of these girls in bathing suits has led him only to getting fired. But he's young, and maybe the job wasn't up to his level of intelligence anyway. Maybe his parents' hopes for a nice, orderly A&P clerk were pitched too low. I see quite a long future for Sammy in which who knows what nice things will happen to him. But yes, the emptiness, the fear, Ahmad's fear of his faith being taken from him, all of us fearful of whatever faith we have being taken from us. It's hard to live without any faith. Hard to live without faith in something, some purpose, something bigger than you that can use you. You want to be useful. I remember in Kafka's castle, the surveyor, the hero, wants useful work. That's all he wants from the proprietors of the castle. He wants to be hired and do useful work. And I think all of us, to one degree or another, want to do useful work. And how does this tie in with the sense of disappointment? And I think there's always, almost always, our capacity for swallowing defeat and overriding despair is pretty great. I have, you know, Rabbit Run, in a sense, would not seem to be a good prospect for a happy future at the end of, I mean, Rabbit at the end of Rabbit Run would seem to be a pretty hopeless case with no solution, two women reduced to tears and despair because of him, and all they can do is run. But, you know, as I showed in later novels, his life gets together and he does this and that constructively. In some sense, he knuckles under to all that would sully his vision of purity, athletic triumph, but nevertheless. So, however depressing I may be as a writer, as a person, I'm pretty cheerful. thank you.
John Updike, reading from his novel, Terrorist. Thanks for listening. For more readings like this one, please go to npr.org/booktour.